Content note, today's episode of So Many Books, So Little Time contains multiple things that are fairly graphic, including parts of the body that should stay on the inside and not leave the body. So there's some rather graphic injuries described, and in very explicit detail. There's some corruption, there's despicable wheeling and dealing, there's deep philosophical discussions on the futility of war, the need to evolve past it, etc., etc. And I'm trying to think of another thing that definitely happened. I'm just still in a bit of a... Oh, there's hospitals. There's corruption. Discussions of corruption and more corruption. And a lot of musing on the characters and why they made the decisions that they made and how, and so on and so forth.
Hey folks, Dave here.
Andrew.
And welcome to So Many Books.
So Little Time.
Please join us for Chapter 40 of Catch-22, ironically called Catch-22.
Is it eponymously?
I don't know what that word means.
Nominous, the same name. Anonymously. Like, you know, anonymous is without knowing who it is.
Oh, so eponymous is knowing.
Or no, the same name. Epi meaning the same? I don't know.
Oh, okay.
I don't know. I've forgotten. Anyway, yes.
Yeah, it's... It's like, you know, when you're watching a movie or TV show and a character finally says the name of the movie or TV show, and you're like, we have a title.
Yes. So, yeah, apologies if you shouldn't, because the wonderful technical editing skills of Dave shall fix this. But in the background, because it's a muggy, disgustingly muggy day, it's raining and the humidity just will not let up. I have my fan on. And today, for the first time, I realized that the name of the fan, the brand, is Heller, spelt the same way as the author. It gave me a giggle, and I hope it gives you guys a bit of a, that's neat, kind of response. I don't know.
Well, see, you can use the fan, but it will cause problems for our recording. It's a catch-22.
However, if I don't use the fan, I will melt into a pool, and that will also cause problems with the recording.
Yeah, so melted pools do not provide good conversation.
I don't know if unmelted pools do at this point either, but I'm trying my best.
We'll do our best.
Yeah,
it's... well, I was going to think of something to say, but I'm quite tired myself, so maybe we should go right into what happened last chapter, because that's pleasant.
Yes, that was... Yeah, that was a chapter, wasn't it? Yeah.
It was indeed, and we'd like to apologize to our listeners. It turns out that we accidentally uploaded chapter 38 again, so hopefully you folks have listened to our episode 39 before this chapter 40.
Yeah, I fixed it up as soon as I could, as soon as Dave told me, but apologies, that was... When you're multitasking and listening to medical conference at the same time as other life things and also uploading podcast, apologies, these things, yeah.
It happens.
It does.
You know, anything to try and forget the despair of the city of Rome as the Assyrian was walking through.
Oh, no, the Eternal City. Was it the Eternal City?
It was Rome.
Yes, the Eternal City. Yeah, it's pretty bad. It's pretty rough. Without going into more detail, it was there was a lot of violence, there was a lot of hopelessness and despair and injustice. And I mean, actually, it's a really good summary chapter for the whole. It was almost like you saw the real. I mean, it's not that we haven't seen the guts, so to speak, of this war. We've seen, like, occasionally you'd get a really bad flash of something horrible. But this one, it almost felt like the constant horror. Like it was the other chapters where we had this kind of graphic stuff. It was like graphic stuff, humor, graphic stuff, distraction, very mundane kind of conversation about, I don't know, supplies, where it was horrible things, but it wasn't like the actual hurt and harm and problems that are being caused to the actual population that is there as well. And the injustice and the brutality of it. I think this was, honestly, to me, that was the most brutal chapter.
Yeah, because it wasn't just like an act of horrific, gory violence. It was a consistent deluge of people acting horrible towards other people. And it just actually hit me there. Think about the police in that chapter, because we had a bit of a confrontation with all of them. The police chief, which Milo Yossarian visited at the start of the chapter, was busy entertaining himself with a large woman. And the instant Milo left, he wanted to arrest Yossarian so he could go back and enjoy himself with a large woman. Later, police came by the GI who was having convulsions, and his friends were trying to, you know, lay him on the car, do something to help him. And there was a flippant joke at the man's expense, and then Yossarian fled because it looked like these guys were just out to entertain themselves. And also he realized he didn't have a pass and they'd probably jump on him for that. But then finally, the MPs coming what we thought were to arrest Arfi after he murdered a woman. But no, they were there to arrest Yossarian because he had no pass.
And only to send him home. So the whole thing is, it was very much, it was a chapter about, I guess, the injustice, the abuse of power, those, because remember, he went to Rome because he has this very strong belief that children, that the innocent children, that children should not ever, like, no one would ever want to advance at the expense of the harm of children, right?
Yeah, he went there specifically to find the kid sister.
Yeah, so we have the extreme dehumanization, you've got the extreme injustice, the extreme violence, and no institutions or structures existing to actually uphold rights or to protect those that they are who you would think that they're not actually standing for justice. The institutions are there, but they're corrupt. So it was an extreme kind of chapter, and it was very much, I'm trying to think of a way to put it, because I think that's all I really want to comfortably share right now, but it's because it was a painful chapter to read.
And where were most of the policemen? This hit my brain just then. They were off trying to stop the smuggling of illegal tobacco.
Yeah. And whilst at the same time, as soon as Milo would be in charge, would it be illegal anymore?
Yeah, and the cynic in me thinks the only reason the cops are going after the illegal tobacco is because it's so much cheaper to buy for the general populace than standard tobacco.
Yeah. It all just feels very much like, it's abuse. It's corruption, abuse, exploitation, and it was terrible. The fact that, you know, the crowd was doing nothing to intervene when a child was being hurt, that someone spoke up when a dog was being beaten, but even then they didn't end up doing anything. But and the funny thing for me, the whole chapter was Yossarian kept saying, repeating like these sentiments of, if there was only something that he could do, he throws money at the woman because he thinks that money solves everything, but that doesn't actually solve anything. But it, you know, for him, it's funny how money seems to solve things. But what if they had only asked for help? Because she was basically asking for help, whereas the others didn't. The person who was, I guess, mugged didn't. Remember, there was a lady who was mugged, and if only she had asked for help. But she didn't ask for help from him specifically.
And then we had that discussion where, based on Yossarian not wanting to commit to Dobbs's plan to murder Cathcart, maybe Yossarian would not have been able to help this woman anyway.
Yeah. So there's all these things of, saying that people should do something. People should do something. People should ask for help. People should da da da. And to have all these attitudes, but then does nothing.
Mm-hmm.
It's like you see injustice, you could do something about it, but then you also want to save your own skin and not be arrested by the MPs, but then you also don't want to be killed. But he's also afraid that everyone's out to get him, mm-hmm. which, I mean, in this case they were, but look, yeah. So he actually turned to Milo for help, and the time he turns from Milo for help, Milo gets distracted by his own focus and own needs. Everyone is out to get him, but everyone's also out to get what they want for themselves. And Yossarian sees that, and instead of actually addressing it, even when Milo started to say, Milo, no, please don't. And that, but he already gave up. Yeah. Milo gave up. No, Milo. Yossarian gave up hope.
Because mm-hmm. he's heard this song before, as yeah. the saying goes.
Yeah, but also that, so part of it is Yossarian blaming people for not saying something, but seeing the injustice and doing nothing. Mm. And at the same time, the same person, when he says something and he asks for help, but then when that can't be sustained for whatever reason, he doesn't address that either. So
And maybe also because, like, aside from Hongi Joe, Milo was the last of his support network.
Yes. Yeah, or people that he had some sort of relationship with, despite the fact that everyone seemed to try to sort of have a relationship with him now, at least not whilst others can see him, but one-on-one, they were coming up to him, and because he was walking backwards and refusing to fly.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, the chapter ends with a glimmer of hope, because he, after all the ridiculous amount of MPs muscled him into Colonel Cathcart's office, Korn was sitting on the desk and basically said, well, we're sending you home. But seeing that this chapter is called Catch 22, I don't think it's going to be that simple.
No.
Also, we got 3 chapters left. So I don't think this chapter is going to be Yossarian went home, got the help he needed, the war was won, and everyone lived happily ever after.
Yeah, that's going to be. Let's see what happens. I think that's what's going to happen.
Chapter 40. Catch 22. There was, of course, a catch. Catch 22? Inquired Yossarian. Of course, Colonel Korn answered pleasantly, after he had chased the mighty guard of massive MPs out with an insouciant flick of his hand and a slightly contemptuous nod, most relaxed, as always, when he could be most cynical. His rimless square eyeglasses glinted with sly amusement as he gazed at Yossarian. After all, we can't simply send you home for refusing to fly more missions and keep the rest of the men here, can we? That would hardly be fair to them. You're goddamn right, Colonel Cathcart blurted out, lumbering back and forth gracelessly like a winded bull, puffing and pouting angrily. I'd like to tie him up hand and foot and throw him aboard a plane on every mission. That's what I'd like to do. Colonel Korn motioned Colonel Cathcart to be silent and smiled at Yossarian. You know, you really have been making things terribly difficult for Colonel Cathcart, he observed with flip good humor, as though the fact did not displease him at all. The men are unhappy, and morale is beginning to deteriorate, and it's all your fault. It's your fault, Yossarian argued, for raising the number of missions. No, it's your fault for refusing to fly them, Colonel Korn retorted. The men were perfectly content to fly as many missions as we asked, as long as they thought they had no alternative. Now you've given them hope, and they're unhappy, so the blame is all yours. Doesn't he know there's a war going on? Colonel Cathcart, still stamping back and forth, demanded morosely without looking at Yossarian. I'm quite sure he does, Colonel Korn answered. That's probably why he refuses to fly them. Doesn't it make any difference to him? Will the knowledge that there's a war going on weaken your decision to refuse to participate in it? Colonel Korn inquired with sarcastic seriousness, mocking Colonel Cathcart. No, sir, Yossarian replied, almost returning Colonel Korn's smile. I was afraid of that, Colonel Korn remarked with an elaborate sigh, locking his fingers together comfortably on top of his smooth, bald, broad, shiny brown head. You know, in all fairness, we really haven't treated you too badly, have we? We fed you and paid you on time. We gave you a medal and even made you a captain. I should never have made him a captain, Colonel Cathcart exclaimed bitterly. I should have given him a court-martial after he loused up that Ferreira mission and went around twice. I told you not to promote him, said Colonel Korn, but you wouldn't listen to me. No, you didn't. You told me to promote him, didn't you? I told you not to promote him, but you just wouldn't listen. I should have listened. You never listen to me, Colonel Korn persisted with relish. That's the reason we're in this spot. All right, gee whiz, stop rubbing it in, will you? Colonel Cathcart burrowed his fists down deep inside his pockets and turned away in a slouch. Instead of picking on me, why don't you figure out what we're going to do about him? We're going to send him home, I'm afraid, Colonel Corn was chuckling triumphantly when he turned away from Colonel Cathcart to face the Assyrian. "Assyrian, the war is over for you. We're going to send you home. You really don't deserve it, you know, which is one of the reasons I don't mind doing it. Since there is nothing else we can risk doing to you at this time, we've decided to return you to the States. We've worked out this little deal to..." "What kind of deal?" Yessarian demanded with defiant mistrust. Colonel Korn tossed his head back and laughed. "Oh, a thoroughly despicable deal. Make no mistake about that. It's absolutely revolting, but you'll accept it quickly enough." "Don't be too sure. I haven't the slightest doubt you will, even though it stinks to high heaven. Oh, by the way, you haven't told any of the men you've refused to fly more missions, have you?" "No, sir," Yessarian answered promptly. Colonel Korn nodded approvingly. "That's good. I like the way you lie. You'll go far in this world if you ever acquire some decent ambition." "Doesn't he know there's a war going on?" Colonel Cathcart yelled out suddenly and blew with vigorous disbelief into the open end of his cigarette holder. "I'm quite sure he does," Colonel Korn replied acidly, "since you brought that identical point to his attention just a moment ago." Colonel Korn frowned warily for Yessarian's benefit, his eyes twinkling swarthily with sly and daring scorn. Gripping the edge of Colonel Cathcart's desk with both hands, he lifted his flaccid haunches far back on the corner to sit with both short legs dangling freely. His shoes kicked lightly against the yellow oak wood. His sludge-brown socks, garterless, collapsed in sagging circles below ankles that were surprisingly small and white. "You know, Yessarian," he mused affably in a manner of casual reflection that seemed both derisive and sincere, "I really do admire you a bit. You're an intelligent person of great moral character who has taken a very courageous stand. I'm an intelligent person with no moral character at all, so I'm in an ideal position to appreciate it." "These are very critical times," Colonel Cathcart asserted petulantly from a far corner of the office, paying no attention to Colonel Korn. "Very critical times indeed," Colonel Korn agreed with a placid nod. "We've just had a change of command above, and we can't afford a situation that might put us in a bad light with either General Shostakov or General Peckham. Isn't that what you mean, Colonel? Hasn't he got any patriotism?" "Won't you fight for your country?" Colonel Korn demanded, emulating Colonel Cathcart's self-righteous tone. "Won't you give up your life for Colonel Cathcart and me?" Yessarian tensed with alert astonishment when he heard Colonel Korn's concluding words. "What's that?" he exclaimed. "What have you and Colonel Cathcart got to do with my country? You're not the same." "How can you separate us?" Colonel Korn inquired with ironical tranquility. "That's right," Colonel Cathcart cried emphatically. "You're either for us or against us. There's no two ways about it." "I'm afraid he's got you," added Colonel Korn. "You're either for us or against your country. It's as simple as that." "Oh no, Colonel, I don't buy that." Colonel Korn was unruffled. "Neither do I, frankly, but everyone else will. So there you are." "You're a disgrace to your uniform," Colonel Cathcart declared with blustering wrath, whirling to confront Yessarian for the first time. "I'd like to know how you ever got to be a captain anyway." "You promoted him," Colonel Korn reminded, stifling a snicker. "Don't you remember?" "Well, I never should have done it." "I told you not to do it," Colonel Korn said, "but you just wouldn't listen to me." "Gee whiz, will you stop rubbing it in?" Colonel Cathcart cried. He furrowed his brow and glowered at Colonel Korn through eyes narrow with suspicion, his fists clenched on his hips. "Say, whose side are you on, anyway?" "Your side, Colonel. What other side could I be on?" "Then stop picking on me, will you? Get off my back, will you?" "I'm on your side, Colonel. I'm just loaded with patriotism." "Well, just make sure you don't forget that." Colonel Cathcart turned away grudgingly after another moment, incompletely reassured, and began striding the floor, his hands kneading his long cigarette holder. He jerked a thumb toward Yessarian. "Let's settle with him. I know what I'd like to do with him. I'd like to take him outside and shoot him. That's what I'd like to do with him. That's what General Dreidel would do with him." "But General Dreidel isn't with us anymore," said Colonel Korn, "so we can't take him outside and shoot him." Now that his moment of tension with Colonel Cathcart had passed, Colonel Korn relaxed again and resumed kicking softly against Colonel Cathcart's desk. He returned to Yessarian. "So we're going to send you home instead. It took a bit of thinking, but we finally worked out this horrible little plan for sending you home without causing too much dissatisfaction among the friends you'll leave behind. Doesn't that make you happy?" "What kind of plan? I'm not sure I'm going to like it." "I know you're not going to like it," Colonel Korn laughed, locking his hands contentedly on top of his head again. "You're going to loathe it. It really is odious, and certainly will offend your conscience. But you'll agree to it quickly enough. You'll agree to it because it will send you home safe and sound in 2 weeks, and because you have no choice. It's that or a court-martial. Take it or leave it. Isarian snorted. Stop bluffing, Colonel. You can't court-martial me for desertion in the face of the enemy. It would make you look bad, and you probably couldn't get a conviction. But we can court-martial you now for desertion from duty, since you went to Rome without a pass, and we can make it stick. If you think about it a minute, you'll see that you'd leave us with no alternative. We can't simply let you keep walking around in open insubordination without punishing you. All the other men would stop flying missions, too. No, you have my word for it. We will court-martial you if you turn our deal down, even though it would raise a lot of questions and be a terrible black eye for Colonel Cathcart. Colonel Cathcart winced at the words black eye, and without any apparent premeditation, hurled his slender onyx and ivory cigarette holder down viciously on the wooden surface of his desk. Jesus Christ, he shouted unexpectedly. I hate this goddamn cigarette holder. The cigarette holder bounced off the desk to the wall, ricocheted across the windowsill to the floor, and came to a stop almost where he was standing. Colonel Cathcart stared down at it with an irascible scowl. I wonder if it's really doing me any good. It's a feather in your cap with General Peckham, but a black eye for you with General Scheisskopf, Colonel Korn informed him with a mischievous look of innocence. Well, which one am I supposed to please? Both. How can I please them both? They hate each other. How am I ever going to get a feather in my cap from General Scheisskopf without getting a black eye from General Peckham? March. Yeah, March. That's the only way to please him. March, march, Colonel Cathcart grimaced sullenly. Some generals. They're a disgrace to their uniforms. If people like those two can make general, I don't see how I can miss. You're going to go far, Colonel Korn assured him with a flat lack of conviction, and turned back chuckling to Yusarian. His disdainful merriment increasing at the sight of Yusarian's unyielding expression of antagonism and distrust. And there you have the crux of the situation. Colonel Cathcart wants to be a general, and I want to be a colonel, and that's why we have to send you home. Why does he want to be a general? Why? For the same reason that I want to be a colonel. What else have we got to do? Everyone teaches us to aspire to higher things. A general is higher than a colonel, and a colonel is higher than a lieutenant colonel. So we're both aspiring. And you know, Yusarian, it's a lucky thing for you that we are. Your timing on this is absolutely perfect. But I suppose you took that factor into account in your calculations. I haven't been doing any calculating, Yusarian retorted. Yes, I really do enjoy the way you lie, Colonel Korn answered. Won't it make you proud to have your commanding officer promoted to general? To know you served in an outfit that averaged more combat missions per person than any other? Don't you want to earn more unit citations and more oak leaf clusters for your air medal? Where's your esprit de corps? Don't you want to contribute further to this great record by flying more combat missions? It's your last chance to answer yes. No. In that case, you have us over a barrel, said Colonel Korn without rancor. He ought to be ashamed of himself. And we have to send you home. Just do a few little things for us and... What sort of things? Yusarian interrupted with belligerent misgiving. Oh, tiny, insignificant things. Really, this is a very generous deal we're making with you. We will issue orders returning you to the States. Really, we will. And all you have to do in return is... What? What must I do? Colonel Korn laughed curtly. Like us. Yusarian blinked. Like you? Like us. Like you? That's right, said Colonel Korn, nodding gratified immeasurably by Yusarian's guileless surprise and bewilderment. Like us. Join us. Be our pal. Say nice things about us here and back in the States. Become one of the boys. Now, that isn't asking too much, is it? You just want me to like you? Is that all? That's all. That's all. Just find it in your heart to like us. Yusarian wanted to laugh confidently when he saw with amazement that Colonel Korn was telling the truth. That isn't going to be too easy, he sneered. Oh, it will be a lot easier than you think, Colonel Korn taunted in return, undismayed by Yusarian's barb. You'll be surprised at how easy you'll find it to like us once you begin. Colonel Korn hitched up the waist of his loose, voluminous trousers. The deep black grooves isolating his square chin from his jowls were bent again in a kind of jeering and reprehensible mirth. You see, Yusarian, we're going to put you on Easy Street. We're going to promote you to Major and even give you another medal. Captain Flume is already working on glowing press releases describing your valor over Ferrera your deep and abiding loyalty to your outfit, and your consummate dedication to duty. Those phrases are all actual quotations, by the way. We're going to glorify you and send you home a hero, recalled by the Pentagon for morale and public relations purposes. You'll live like a millionaire. Everyone will lionize you. You'll have parades in your honor and make speeches to raise money for war bonds. A whole new world of luxury awaits you once you become our pal. Isn't it lovely? Yessarian found himself listening intently to the fascinating elucidation of details. I'm not sure I want to make speeches. Then we'll forget the speeches. The important thing is what you say to people here. Colonel Korn leaned forward earnestly, no longer smiling. We don't want any of the men in the group to know that we're sending you home as a result of your refusal to fly more missions. And we don't want General Peckham or General Shizkov to get wind of any friction between us either. That's why we're going to become such good pals. What will I say to the men who asked me why I refused to fly more missions? Tell them you had been informed in confidence that you were being returned to the States and that you were unwilling to risk your life for another mission or two. Just a minor disagreement between pals, that's all. Will they believe it? Of course they'll believe it once they see what great friends we've become, and when they see the press releases and read the flattering things you have to say about me and Colonel Cathcart. Don't worry about the men. They'll be easy enough to discipline and control when you're gone. It's only while you're still here that they may prove troublesome. You know, one good apple can spoil the rest, Colonel Korn concluded with conscious irony. You know, this would really be wonderful. You might even serve as an inspiration to them to fly more missions. Suppose I denounce you when I get back to the States. After you accepted our medal and promotion and all the fanfare, no one would believe you. The army wouldn't let you. And why in the world should you want to? You're going to be one of the boys, remember? You'll enjoy a rich, rewarding, luxurious, privileged existence. You'd have to be a fool to throw it all away just for a moral principle, and you're not a fool. Is it a deal? I don't know. It's that or a court-martial. That's a pretty scummy trick I'd be playing on the men in the squadron, isn't it? Odious, Colonel Korn agreed amiably, and waited, watching Yessarian patiently with a glimmer of private delight. But what the hell, Yessarian exclaimed. If they don't want to fly more missions, let them stand up and do something about it the way I did, right?
And this is the thing with Yessarian. He's got some sort of moral fiber, but he just lacks the... Yeah. It's the, if they needed help, they should speak up. It's so not right to have injustice around me, but does nothing. It's really...
I had it hard. Why shouldn't other people?
No, but also there's something about him that's completely broken now.
Well, there's that too.
He just doesn't want to fly anymore. And if it means he can go home, at this point, he doesn't care anymore. And we already know he should have been sent home way earlier.
And I think not only of that's not only going to be the critical choice of the chapter, that's going to be the critical choice of the novel. Is he broken enough to give up his principles?
I think he's broken. I think he's gone past his principles now.
Let them stand up and do something about it the way I did, right? Of course, said Colonel Korn. There's no reason I have to risk my life for them, is there? Of course not. Yessarian arrived at his decision with a swift grin. It's a deal, he announced jubilantly. Great, said Colonel Korn with somewhat less cordiality than Yessarian had expected, and he slid himself off Colonel Cathcart's desk to stand on the floor. He tugged the folds of cloth of his pants and undershorts free from his crotch and gave Yessarian a limp handshake. Welcome aboard. Thanks, Colonel. Call me Blackie, John. We're pals now. Sure, Blackie. My friends call me Yo-Yo. Blackie, his friends call him Yo-Yo, Colonel Korn sang out to Colonel Cathcart. Why don't you congratulate Yo-Yo on what a sensible move he's making? That's a real sensible move you're making, Yo-Yo, Colonel Cathcart said, pumping the Sarian's hand with clumsy zeal. Thank you, Colonel. I call him Chuck, said Colonel Korn. Sure, call me Chuck, said Colonel Cathcart with a laugh that was hearty and awkward. We're all pals now. Sure, Chuck. Exit smiling, said Colonel Korn, his hands on both their shoulders as the three of them moved to the door. Come on over for dinner with us some night, Yo-Yo, Colonel Cathcart invited hospitably. How about tonight, in the group dining room? I'd love to, sir. Chuck, Colonel Korn corrected reprovingly. I'm sorry, Blackie. Chuck, I can't get used to it. That's all right, pal. Sure, pal. Thanks, pal. Don't mention it, pal. So long, pal. Yessarian waved goodbye fondly to his new pals and sauntered out onto the balcony corridor, almost bursting into song the instant he was alone. He was home free. He had pulled it off. His act of rebellion had succeeded. He was safe, and he had nothing to be ashamed of to anyone. He started towards the staircase.
Stop, going back. Because the people that he cared for and respected aren't around anymore.
Yeah, Hungry Joe is the only one left, right?
Yeah.
He started toward the staircase with a jaunty and exhilarated air. A private in green fatigue saluted him. Yessarian returned the salute happily, staring at the private with curiosity. He looked strangely familiar. When Yessarian returned the salute, the private in green fatigues turned suddenly into Nately's and lunged at him murderously with a bone-handled kitchen knife that caught him in the side below his upraised arm. Yessarian sank to the floor with a shriek, shutting his eyes in overwhelming terror as he saw the girl lift the knife to strike at him again. He was already unconscious when Colonel Korn and Colonel Cathcart dashed out of the office and saved his life by frightening her away.
Yeah, he's hit the point where he's broken his principles completely.
It's, like, I guess I'm still processing it, but just the, not only the switch of, like, Colonel Cathcart, you know, being, wanting to shoot him, basically, and then, I mean, obviously he was begrudgingly being friendly at the end, but...
Well, begrudgingly slash Korn runs the show. We've said this much earlier, that I'm of the opinion that Korn runs everything, really. Is the puppet master here. I also wonder if he's the one who controlled the interrogation of the chaplain.
Could be.
There's something about him that's he's very much just... Because the reason Cathcart likes him is that he doesn't seem to be super ambitious, but the reality is he is ambitious. It's just he's playing the long game.
That idea of, I won't rise as far as certain people, but I will. They will basically be my puppets, so I will be in control without being in control.
And even though he will be advancing, he is aiming to advance, but he's trying to do it in a way that he's thinking he doesn't want to be a Peckham situation, he doesn't want to be a Dreidel situation, he wants to be the one who lasts past all of them, and the only way you do that is you play the long game.
I did like that little... bit where Yessarian honestly asked Cathcart, like, why do you want to be a general? And Korn was like, aspirations. You know, it wasn't really an answer, but he's like, you always want to go higher. That's the whole point of it, right?
It's a game for Korn. Korn's got the intelligence, but not the principles. Cathcart does not have the brain or the principles. Cathcart's, we've said this before, he's not quite there either. He should not be serving in any capacity. I mean, none of them should be, really, but...
I'd kind of like to go back and see if... Because I can't remember if Korn actually did try and dissuade Cathcart from promoting him or not.
I don't think he did.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure
no,
he didn't.
No, he said, we're going to give him a medal and a promotion. And I think he said, we're going to give him a medal. Yeah, and a promotion, and I'm fairly sure he suggested it, and Kafka said, really? And said, yeah, because it's going to look better. Because he wanted to court-martial him. Cathcart wanted to court-martial him. Korn said, no, this is what you're going to do.
Right, yeah. Well, I mean, that makes sense to me, even though I can't quite remember it.
It's the whole thing is so weird and twisted, and it's very much... Wasn't Korn Peckham's man as well?
I think they saw that he was the best way to advance. To be honest, I don't think Korn has any allegiance, really.
No. But I think that he worked with Peckham in that sense. And that's why he was frustrated, because he was working under Dreidel.
And I think it's a beautiful irony now that they're being governed by two generals who are complete opposites. So if you want to get in with one, you're going to displease the other.
Yeah, well, one just wants marching, and that's it. And the other one wants you to...
And I love how incensed Cathcart is about the marching, too.
Yeah, well, none of them want to march. They it's pointless. It's a very silly thing to do. And it's funny because... So they get the men to fly the missions, and they keep increasing the missions to make themselves look good, right? Cathcart is being asked the men to do something that he doesn't want to do, but... would make him look good in front of the general. And it's what the general wants. And technically, it's good for PR as well, because it looks good when you have, like, videos of people marching and whatever.
Yeah.
So it's It's a bit of like when the shoe's on your foot, you don't like it, but the hypocrisy is like outstanding hypocrisy the whole way through.
Well, I think he's also just incompetent. He can't see how marching would benefit him.
No.
And he seems to be, I can't remember if we've had examples of this, but he seems to be the type of person, if the idea didn't come from him, it's worthless.
Yeah, but even when the idea does come from him, he worries, because remember, he worried whether his idea was actually going to be a good one or not. So, oh no, maybe it's a bad idea. Oh no, no, no. And then so as soon as someone gives him an idea and he thinks it's a good idea, then he claims that he came up with it.
Yeah, that conversation with the chaplain. When the chaplain tried to dissuade him against the Sunday. No, it was before the service before going into combat.
And he said, okay, but we, like, and then the whole idea that, oh no, well, what about the people who don't believe in God? Oh, but that's not possible, you know, well, we'll just have to do it and that'll be fine. And then, oh no, but what, so the enlisted men and the officers, like, wait, no, they don't pray to the same God, right? Like, it's,
I do want to also bring up with, because you talked before, you mentioned how Corm probably views this all as a game. I really got that impression this chapter because
it's entertainment for him. Yeah.
Yeah. He's fully aware of, well, at least before Ysirian was broken, when he had principles, he's fully aware of how he used the word odious, the idea of his salvation would be. And he takes delight in being able to tell him this.
But also Ysirian is known for being a bit of a stirrer when it comes to the, like, he does the whole pranking kind of thing. That used to be him, I guess, before.
Yeah.
He was broken by Snowden, because he's got the whole getting into fights and teasing and going into the hospital and avoiding things and the whole soap in the, like, there's things that they know have happened without knowing that they've happened, and they know Ysirian somehow connected to it. This stuff, and I think he does have, I mean, Ysirian is completely just ethically, morally smashed. That doesn't help. And the trip to Rome probably just cemented it even further with the whole situation with Michaela.
And it was the leverage they needed to really put their plan into motion.
Yeah. But the whole, and Milo just being so one-track mind, kind of profit, profit, profit. Even when the daughter, the concept of, hey, you know what it's like to have kids.
Mm-hmm.
Even that couldn't appeal and sustain him. His greed was greater.
Which, you know, that was the first time we heard about that. And I was like, oh God, Milo's got children. There's four kids.
Yeah. But yeah, so it's interesting. But yeah, Corn feels like he's behind a lot of the things. I wonder also if he manipulates a lot of...
Corn wants to be a Wintergreen.
Corn and Wintergreen are, yeah, very similar. Except Wintergreen constantly gets demoted. But he's doing it almost intentionally.
Yes. It seems like a very similar idea. You don't want to rise too far up, because then you can be
held vulnerable. Accountable. Yeah. And also that way you paint a big target on your back.
Yeah. Oh, that... Yeah. And then, of course, just almost as a final laugh, Ysirian's now on top of the world. It's like the giant weight has been lifted. He's like, you know, he's not even really understanding kind of what they're asking of him, really.
No, but he does. He does. It's a pretty scummy trick I'll be playing on the men in the squadron, isn't it? He knows. He's hit the point where he knows, and he's hit the point where he just doesn't care anymore. The people who would have kept him grounded, so Dunbar, the chaplain, I think, I'm wondering if the chaplain's ducked his head down a bit.
Or if he, by this point in the story, he's gone and we jumped ahead a bit, so we never found out.
We don't know, yeah. Either the chaplain's gone or the chaplain's avoiding Ysirian because he's, that was maybe the whole point. Intimidating him so he stays away from Ysirian.
Could be, yeah. When they grabbed the chaplain, he was going to give comfort to Ysirian because Baitley had died.
Yeah, yeah. And so Ysirian ended up going AWOL.
And, but going back to that like final joke where he's on top of the world, like the way to, he's, oh my God, I'm going home. And he's like, that private looks familiar. And it turns out to be Naylee's girlfriend with knife. And she actually stabs him. So for the second time, he's probably going to be sent to the hospital for a real reason.
Probably. It's just weird. The whole thing is very weird. And so we've got the, and then we're still questioning whether it is actually Natalie's or not.
Because although, again, this could be Ysarion's point, you know.
Ysarion's reality is a little bit shaky.
Yeah, but like at the end, it did say that Khorne and Kafka were running out to scare her off. Well,
yeah, but I mean, she whether it's her or
he might have just collapsed. Yeah, and they saw him collapse in the
rain. That or someone might have attacked him, but it mightn't have been her, and he's just having flashbacks, or something about this whole situation has knocked him out. I don't know. It's just a bit weird. He might not be the only, like, it could be another, because remember, Ysarion has been with a few women as well. But also it could be the kid's sister.
Could be.
We don't know what's happening. Whether Milo sent Natalie's because Milo's the only one that I can see is getting behind enemy lines and coordinating some sort of retrieval. Also, yeah. who helped her be dropped off behind the lines? Was it Hungry Joe?
I think it was, wasn't it? Because
Hungry Joe and him flew out, dropped her off behind enemy lines, and flew back.
Oh yeah, I'm just so tired today that my memory's not working.
I can't remember who it was but it was something like that. Because they kind of went, yeah, this is ridiculous. But the fact that she's back, and also the way Hungry Joe is, you can't be entirely sure that someone couldn't convince him.
Perhaps she told Joe that I'll let you take pictures of me.
Yeah, and immediately flies back. It's just, there's something about this whole situation. You can't, it's weird because you can't tell whether it's real or not.
At this point, yeah. I mean, my default is to see this as real, but there is that option that, yeah, it could be.
Yeah, so yeah, it's unknown whether it could have been Ysarion, just the last bit of his conscience or his morals or his whatever, just kind of making him, like, he might have seen someone on the stairs and just collapsed or fallen down the stairs, or someone might have attacked him. We don't know. It's weird.
Well, it turns out that the chapter was a lot shorter than I was anticipating. So why don't we go ahead and read the penultimate chapter?
Yeah.
You know, for the longest time in my life, I thought penultimate actually meant like ultimate. And then I believe it was a professor at uni heard me say it once and was like, no, Dave, it means the one right before the ultimate.
Ah. So it's just before ultimate. So penultimate chapters. Which means then we will introduce this to the book that we're going to be reading after that, next time.
Yeah, no, next episode's going to be fun because it'll be the final chapter. And we made the promise that we're going to get right into it after a quick recap, just so once the book is over, Rue can find her timeline, and we can go through the events, and hopefully make more of a clearer picture of everything.
Yes, it'll plus, be a little plus, less chaotic.
As we usually do, go through the book as a whole, kind of our closing thoughts, all that, and then, yes, we'll let you know what what Rue has decided we will read after this book is over.
Yes. But in the meantime, we shall continue with the chapter called Snowden.
Yeah, I have a feeling we might be jumping back again. We haven't done that for a while.
I don't know.
We will see.
No, it doesn't look... I don't know. It looks more like it's flat, maybe flashbacks as well.
Chapter 41. Snowden. Cut, said a doctor. You cut, said another. No cuts, said Ysarion, with a thick, unwieldy tongue. Now look who's buddying, complained one of the doctors. Another count he heard from. Are we going to operate, or aren't we? He doesn't need an operation, complained the other. It's a small wound. All we have to do is stop the bleeding, clean it out, and put a few stitches in. But I've never had the chance to operate before. Which one is the scalpel? Is this one the scalpel? No, the other one is the scalpel. Well, go ahead and cut already if you're going to. Make the incision. Like this? Not there, you dope. No incisions, Yessarian said, perceiving through the lifting fog of insensibility that the two strangers were ready to begin cutting him. Another count he heard from, complained the first doctor sarcastically. Is he going to keep talking that way while I operate on him? You can't operate on him until I admit him, said a clerk. You can't admit him until I clear him, said a fat, gruff colonel, with a mustache and an enormous pink face that pressed down very close to Yessarian and radiated scorching heat like the bottom of a huge frying pan. Where were you born? The fat, gruff colonel reminded Yessarian of the fat, gruff colonel who had interrogated the chaplain and found him guilty. Yessarian stared up at him through a glassy film. The cloying scents of formaldehyde and alcohol sweeted the air. On a battlefield, he answered. No, no. In what state were you born? In a state of innocence. No, no, you don't understand. Let me handle him.
Sorry, back. The fat, gruff colonel reminded Yessarian of the fat, gruff colonel who had interrogated the chaplain and found him guilty. How does he know?
Chaplain may have told him.
Maybe. No, but reminding him means he had to be there.
Okay.
That's weird.
Let me handle him, urged a hatchet-faced man with sunken, acrimonious eyes and a thin, malevolent mouth. Are you a smart aleck or something? He asked the Yessarian. He's delirious, one of the doctors said. Why don't you let us take him back inside and treat him? Leave him right there if he's delirious. He might say something incriminating. But he's still bleeding profusely. Can't you see? He might even die. Good for him. It would serve the finky bastard right, said the fat, gruff colonel. All right, John, let's speak out. We want to get to the truth. Everyone calls me Yo-Yo. We want you to cooperate with us, Yo-Yo. We're your friends, and we want you to trust us. We're here to help you. We're not going to hurt you. Let's jab our thumbs down inside the wound and gouge it, suggested the hatched-faced man. Yessarian let his eyes fall closed and hoped they would think he was unconscious. He's fainted, he heard the doctor say. Can't we treat him now before it's too late? He really might die. All right, take him. I hope the bastard does die. You can't treat him until I admit him, the clerk said. Yessarian played dead with his eyes shut while the clerk admitted him by shuffling some papers, and then he was rolled away slowly into a stuffy dark room with searing spotlights overhead in which the cloying smell of formaldehyde and sweet alcohol was even stronger. The pleasant, permeating stink was intoxicating. He smelled ether, too, and heard glass tinkling. He listened with secret, egotistical mirth to the husky breathing of the two doctors. It delighted him that they thought he was unconscious. It did not know he was listening. It all seemed very silly to him until one of the doctors said, "Well, do you think we should save his life? They might be sore at us if we do." "Let's operate," said the other doctor. "Let's cut him open and get to the inside of things once and for all. He keeps complaining about his liver. His liver looks pretty small on this x-ray. That's his pancreas, you dope. This is his liver. No, it isn't. That's his heart. I'll bet you a nickel this is his liver. I'm going to operate and find out. Should I wash my hands first?" "No operations," Yessarian said, opening his eyes and trying to sit up. "Another county heard from," scoffed one of the doctors indignantly. "Can't we make him shut up?" "We could give him a total. The ether's right here." "No total," said Yessarian. "Another county heard from," said a doctor. "Let's give him a total and knock him out. Then we can do what we want with him." They gave Yessarian total anesthesia and knocked him out. He woke up thirsty in a private room drowning in ether fumes. Colonel Korn was there at his bedside, waiting calmly in a chair in his baggy wool olive drab shirt and trousers. A bland, phlegmatic smile hung on his brown face with its heavy bearded cheeks, and he was buffing the facets of his bald head gently with the palms of both hands. He bent forward chuckling when Yessarian awoke and assured him in the friendliest tones that the deal they had made was still on if Yessarian didn't die. Yessarian vomited, and Colonel Korn shot to his feet at the first cough and fled in disgust. So it seemed indeed that there was a silver lining to every cloud, Yessarian reflected, as he drifted back into a suffocating daze. A hand with sharp fingers shook him awake roughly. He turned and opened his eyes and saw a strange man with a mean face who curled his lip at him in a spiteful scowl and bragged. "We've got your pal, buddy. We've got your pal." Yessarian turned cold and faint and broke into a sweat. "Who's my pal?" he asked when he saw the chaplain sitting where Colonel Korn had been sitting. "Maybe I'm your pal," the chaplain answered. But Yessarian couldn't hear him and closed his eyes. Someone gave him water to sip and tiptoed away. He slept and woke up feeling great until he turned his head to smile at the chaplain and saw Arfi there instead. Yusarian moaned instinctively and screwed his face up with excruciating irritability when Arfi chortled and asked how he was feeling. Arfi looked puzzled when Yusarian inquired why he was not in jail. Yusarian shut his eyes to make him go away. When he opened them, Arfi was gone and the chaplain was there. Yusarian broke into laughter when he spied the chaplain's cheerful grin and asked him what in the hell he was so happy about. "I'm happy about you," the chaplain replied with excited candor and joy. "I heard at group that you were very seriously injured and that you would have to be sent home if you lived. Colonel Korn said your condition was critical, but I've just learned from one of the doctors that your wound is really a very slight one and that you'll probably be able to leave in a day or two. You're in no danger. It isn't bad at all." Yusarian listened to the chaplain's news with enormous relief. "That's good." "Yes," said the chaplain, a pink flush of impish pleasure creeping into his cheeks. "Yes, that is good." Yusarian laughed, recalling his first conversation with the chaplain. "You know, the first time I met you was in the hospital, and now I am in the hospital again. Just about the only time I see you lately is in the hospital. Where have you been keeping yourself?" The chaplain shrugged.
The question. He's been, because that's why he hasn't been seeing him.
The chaplain shrugged. "I've been praying a lot," he confessed. "I try to stay in my tent as much as I can, and I pray every time Sergeant Wickham leaves the area, so that he won't catch me." "Does it do any good?" "It takes my mind off my troubles," the chaplain answered with another shrug, "and it gives me something to do." "Well, that's good then, isn't it?" "Yes," agreed the chaplain enthusiastically, as though the idea had not occurred to him before. "Yes, I guess that is good." He bent forward impulsively with awkward solicitude. "Yusarian, is there anything I can do for you while you're here? Anything I can get you?" Yusarian teased him jovially, like toys or candy or chewing gum. The chaplain blushed again, grinning self-consciously, and then turned very respectful. "Like books, perhaps, or anything at all. I wish there was something I could do to make you happy. You know, Yusarian, we're all very proud of you." "Proud?" "Yes, of course, for risking your life to stop that Nazi assassin. It was a very noble thing to do." "What Nazi assassin?" "The one that came here to murder Colonel Cathcart and Colonel Korn. And you saved them. He might have stabbed you to death as you grappled with him on the balcony. It's a lucky thing you're alive." Yusarian snickered sardonically when he understood. "That was no Nazi assassin." "Certainly it was. Colonel Korn said it was. That was Natalie's girlfriend, and she was after me, not Colonel Cathcart and Colonel Korn. She's been trying to kill me ever since I broke the news to her that Natalie was dead." "But how could that be?" the chaplain protested in livid and resentful confusion. "Colonel Cathcart and Colonel Korn both saw him as he ran away. The official report says you stopped a Nazi assassin from killing them." "Don't believe the official report," Yusarian advised dryly. "It's part of the deal." "What deal?" "The deal I made with Colonel Cathcart and Colonel Korn. They'll let me go home a big hero if I say nice things about them to everybody and never criticize them to anyone for making the rest of the men fly more missions." The chaplain was appalled and rose halfway out of his chair. He bristled with bellicose dismay. "Oh, that's terrible. That's a shameful, scandalous deal, isn't it?" "Odious," the Yusarian answered, staring up woodenly at the ceiling, with just the back of his head resting on the pillow. "I think odious is the word we decided on." "Then how could you agree to it?" "It's that or a court-martial, chaplain." "Oh," the chaplain exclaimed with a look of stark remorse, the back of his hand covering his mouth. He lowered himself into his chair uneasily. "I shouldn't have said anything. They'd lock me in prison with a bunch of criminals." "Of course, you must do whatever you think is right, then." The chaplain nodded to himself as though deciding the argument and lapsed into embarrassed silence. "Don't worry," Yusarian said with a sorrowful laugh after several moments had passed. "I'm not going to do it." "But you must do it," the chaplain insisted, bending forward with concern. "Really, you must. I had no right to influence you. I really had no right to say anything." "You didn't influence me." Yusarian hauled himself over onto his side and shook his head in solemn mockery. "Christ, chaplain, can you imagine that for a sin? Saving Colonel Cathcart's life. That's one crime I don't want on my record." The chaplain returned to the subject with caution. "What will you do instead? You can't let them put you in prison." "I'll fly more missions, or maybe I really will desert and let them catch me. They probably would. And they'd put you in prison. You don't want to go to prison." Then I'll just keep flying missions until the war ends, I guess. Some of us have to survive. But you might get killed. Then I guess I won't fly any more missions. What will you do? I don't know. Will you let them send you home? I don't know. Is it hot out? It's very warm in here. It's very cold out, the chaplain said. You know, Yusarian remembered, a very funny thing happened. Maybe I dreamed it. I think a strange man came in here before and told me he's got my pal. I wonder if I imagined it. I don't think you did, the chaplain informed him. You started to tell me about him when I dropped in earlier. Then he really did say it. We've got your pal, buddy, he said. We've got your pal. He had the most malignant manner I ever saw. I wonder who my pal is. I like to think that I'm your pal, Yusarian, the chaplain said with humble sincerity. They certainly have got me. They've got my number, and they've got me under surveillance. And they've got me right where they want me. That's what they told me at my interrogation. No, I don't think it's you, he meant, Yusarian decided. I think it must be someone like Natalie or Dunbar. You know, someone who was killed in the war, like Clevenger, or Dobbs, Kid Sampson, or McWatt. Yusarian emitted a startled gasp and shook his head. I just realized it, he exclaimed. They've got all my pals, haven't they? The only ones left are me and Hungry Joe. He tingled with dread as he saw the chaplain's face go pale. Chaplain, what is it? Hungry Joe was killed. God, no! On a mission? He died in his sleep while having a dream. They found a cat on his face. Sorry, I know I shouldn't laugh. That's... Because that was the thing, wasn't it? The cat would always sleep on his face.
And it terrified him, yeah. Poor man.
Oh, what a way to go. Poor bastard, Yusarian said, and began to cry, hiding his tears in the crook of his shoulder. The chaplain left without saying goodbye. Yusarian ate something and went to sleep. A hand shook him awake in the middle of the night. He opened his eyes and saw a thin, mean man in a patient's bathrobe and pajamas who looked at him with a nasty smirk and jeered. We've got your pal, buddy. We've got your pal. Yusarian was unnerved. What the hell are you talking about? He pleaded in an incipient panic. You'll find out, buddy. You'll find out. Yusarian lunged for his tormentor's throat with one hand, but the man glided out of reach effortlessly and vanished into the corridor with a malicious laugh. Yusarian lay there trembling with a pounding pulse. He was bathed in icy sweat. He wondered who his pal was. It was dark in the hospital and perfectly quiet. He had no watch to tell him the time. He was wide awake and he knew he was a prisoner in one of those sleepless, bedridden nights that would take an eternity to dissolve into dawn. A throbbing chill oozed up his legs. He was cold, and he thought of Snowden, who had never been his pal, but was a vaguely familiar kid who was badly wounded and freezing to death in the puddle of harsh yellow sunlight splashing into his face through the side gunport when Yusarian crawled into the rear section of the plane over to bomb bay after Dobbs had beseeched him on the intercom to help the gunner. Please help the gunner. Yusarian's stomach turned over when his eyes first beheld the macabre scene. He was absolutely revolted, and he paused in fright a few moments before descending, crouched on his hands and knees in the narrow tunnel over the bomb bay beside the sealed corrugated carton containing the first aid kit. Snowden was lying on his back on the floor with his legs stretched out, still burdened cumbersomely by his flak suit, his flak helmet, his parachute harness, and his Mae West. Not far away on the floor lay the small tail gunner in a dead faint. The wound Yusarian saw was in the outside of Snowden's thigh, as large and deep as a football, it seemed. It was impossible to tell where the shreds of his saturated coveralls ended and the ragged flesh began. There was no morphine in the first aid kit, no protection for Snowden against pain but the numbing shock of the gaping wound itself. The 12 sarets of morphine had been stolen from their case and replaced by a cleanly lettered note that said, "What's good for M&M Enterprises is good for the country. Milo Minderbinder." Yusarian swore at Milo and held two aspirins out to ashen lips unable to receive them. But first, he hastily drew a tourniquet around Snowden's thigh because he could not think what else to do in those first tumultuous moments when his senses were in turmoil, when he knew he must act competently at once and feared he might go to pieces completely. Snowden watched him steadily, saying nothing. No artery was spurting, but Yusarian pretended to absorb himself entirely into the fashioning of a tourniquet because applying a tourniquet was something he did know how to do. He worked with simulated skill and composure, feeling Snowden's lackluster gaze resting upon him. He recovered possession of himself before the tourniquet was finished and loosened it immediately to lessen the danger of gangrene. His mind was clear now, and he knew how to proceed. He rummaged through the first aid kit for scissors. "I'm cold," Snowden said softly. "I'm cold." "You're going to be all right, kid," Yusering reassured him with a grin. "You're going to be all right." "I'm cold," Snowden said again in a frail, childlike voice. "I'm cold." "There, there," Yusering said, because he did not know what else to say. "There, there." "I'm cold," Snowden whimpered. "I'm cold. There, there. There, there." Yusering was frightened and moved more swiftly. He found a pair of scissors at last and began cutting carefully through Snowden's coveralls, high up above the wound, just below the groin. He cut through the heavy garbeting cloth all the way around the thigh in a straight line. The tiny tail gunner woke up while Yusering was cutting with the scissors, saw him, and fainted again. Snowden rolled his head to the other side of his neck in order to stare at Yusering more directly. A dim, sunken light glowed in his weak and listless eyes. Yusering, puzzled, tried not to look at him. He began cutting downward through the coveralls along the inside seam. The yawning wound. Was that a tube of slimy bone he saw running deep into the gory scarlet flow behind the twitching, startling fibers of weird muscle? Was dripping blood in several trickles, like snow melting on eaves, but viscous and red, already thickening as it dropped. Yusering kept cutting through the coveralls to the bottom and peeled open the severed leg of the garment. It fell to the floor with a plop, exposing the hem of khaki undershorts that were soaking up blotches of blood on one side as though in thirst. Yusering was stunned at how waxen and ghastly Snowden's bare leg looked, how loathsome, how lifeless and esoteric the downy, fine, curled blonde hairs on his odd, white shin and calf. The wound he saw now was not nearly as large as a football, but as long and wide as his hand, and too raw and deep to see into clearly. The raw muscles inside twitched like live hamburger meat. A long sigh of relief escaped slowly through Yusering's mouth when he saw that Snowden was not in danger of dying. The blood was already coagulating inside the wound, and it was simply a matter of bandaging him up and keeping him calm until the plane landed. He removed some packets of sulfanilamide from the first aid kit. Snowden quivered when Yusering pressed against him gently to turn him up slightly on his side. "Did I hurt you?" "I'm cold," Snowden whimpered. "I'm cold." "There, there," Yusering said. "There, there. I'm cold. I'm cold. There, there. There, there. It's starting to hurt me," Snowden cried out suddenly with a plaintive, urgent wince. Yusering scrambled frantically through the first aid kit in search of morphine again and found only Milo's note and a bottle of aspirin. He cursed Milo and held two aspirin tablets out to Snowden. He had no water to offer. Snowden rejected the aspirin with an almost imperceptible shake of his head. His face was pale and pasty. Yusering removed Snowden's flak helmet and lowered his head to the floor. "I'm cold," Snowden moaned with half-closed eyes. "I'm cold." The edges of his mouth were turning blue. Yusering was petrified. He wondered whether to pull the ripcord of Snowden's parachute and cover him with the nylon folds. It was very warm in the plane. Glancing up unexpectedly, Snowden gave him a wan, cooperative smile and shifted the position of his hips a bit so that Yusering could begin salting the wound with sulfanilamide. Yusering worked with renewed confidence and optimism. The plane bounced hard inside an air pocket, and he remembered with a start that he had left his own parachute up front in the nose. There was nothing to be done about that. He poured envelope after envelope of the white crystalline powder into the bloody oval wound until nothing red could be seen, then drew a deep, apprehensive breath, steeling himself with gritted teeth as he touched his bare hand to the dangling shreds of drying flesh to tuck them up inside the wound. Quickly, he covered the whole wound with a large cotton compress and jerked his hand away. He smiled nervously when his brief ordeal had ended. The actual contact with the dead flesh had not been nearly as repulsive as he had anticipated, and he found excuse to caress the wound with his fingers again and again to convince himself of his own courage. Next, he began binding the compress in place with a roll of gauze. The second time around Snowden's thigh with a bandage, he spotted the small hole on the inside through which the piece of flak had entered. A round, crinkled wound the size of a quarter, with blue edges and a black core inside where the blood had crusted. Yusering sprinkled this one with sulfanilamide too, and continued unwinding the gauze around Snowden's leg until the compress was secure. Then he snipped off the roll with the scissors and slit the end down the center. He made the whole thing fast with a tidy square knot. It was a good bandage, he knew, and he sat back on his heels with pride, wiping the perspiration from his brow, and grinned at Snowden with spontaneous friendliness. "I'm cold," Snowden moaned. "I'm cold." "You're going to be all right, kid," Yessarian assured him, patting his arm comfortingly. "Everything's under control." Snowden shook his head feebly. "I'm cold," he repeated, with eyes as dull and blind as stone. "I'm cold." "There, there," said Yessarian, with growing doubt and trepidation. "There, there. In a little while, we'll be back on the ground, and Dr. Nico will take care of you." But Snowden kept shaking his head and pointed at last with just the barest movement of his chin down toward his armpit. Yessarian bent forward to peer and saw a strangely colored stain seeping through the coveralls just above the armhole of Snowden's flak suit. Yessarian felt his heart stop, then pound so violently he found it difficult to breathe. Snowden was wounded inside his flak suit. Yessarian ripped open the snaps of Snowden's flak suit and heard himself scream wildly as Snowden's inside slithered down to the floor in a soggy pile and just kept dripping out. A chunk of flak, more than 3 inches big, had shot into his other side just underneath the arm and blasted all the way through, drawing whole mottled quarts of Snowden along with it through the gigantic hole in his ribs it made as it blasted out. Yessarian screamed a second time and squeezed both hands over his eyes. His teeth were chattering in horror. He forced himself to look again. Here was God's plenty, all right, he thought bitterly as he stared. Liver, lungs, kidneys, ribs, stomach, and bits of the stewed tomatoes Snowden had eaten that day for lunch. Yessarian hated stewed tomatoes and turned away dizzily and began to vomit, clutching his burning throat. The tail gunner woke up while Yessarian was vomiting, saw him, and fainted again. Yessarian was limp with exhaustion, pain, and despair when he finished. He turned back weakly to Snowden, whose breath had grown softer and more rapid, and whose face had grown paler. He wondered how in the world to begin to save him. "I'm cold," Snowden whimpered. "I'm cold." "There, there," Yessarian mumbled mechanically in a voice too low to be heard. "There, there." Yessarian was cold too, and shivering uncontrollably. He felt goose pimples clacking all over him as he gazed down despondently at the grim secret Snowden had spilled all over the messy floor. It was easy to read the message in his entrails. Man was matter. That was Snowden's secret. Drop him out a window and he'll fall. Set fire to him and he'll burn. Bury him and he'll rot like other kinds of garbage. The spirit gone, man is garbage. That was Snowden's secret. Ripeness was all. "I'm cold," Snowden said. "I'm cold." "There, there," said Yessarian. "There, there." He pulled the ripcord of Snowden's parachute and covered his body with the white nylon sheets. "I'm cold." "There, there."
Man, that's... Oof.
Yeah?
One sec.
Oh, boy. Yeah. Well, yeah. We found a Snowden secret.
Far out.
Yeah. Poor Yessarian.
No surprise that he got completely destroyed.
I think this confirms it. Snowden's death was what tripped the Yessarian. That was the catalyst.
I think Ferreira was where he was still functioning at, like, I need to do my best. I need to protect everyone. I need to do what I can to keep everyone safe and do my job and blah, blah, blah. And then Avignon happens.
Well, I'm thinking Ferreira might have been after Snowden because, remember, he was naked when they tried to pin the nettle on him.
No, I think it happened after. I think it was Ferreira. Then they had the situation with Avignon.
Well, because, remember, Yessarian was naked because he didn't want to wear clothes after Snowden's death.
Yes, but I think that happened after Ferreira. That happened because he had the situation. So Ferreira would have happened before, I think. I think. We'll know next week. We will clarify next week. But I'm fairly sure it was Ferreira, then Snowden, and then also we had the situation with, what's his face? Clevenger as well. I'm curious about who the pal is.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that. Like, I wonder if it's just one of the CID men trying to act tough to try and get information.
Maybe, or it's like, or it's just a patient that's not quite with it.
Or maybe they caught someone like Whitcomb, and, you know, they think he's the Assyrian's pal because they've decided to find him guilty.
Maybe. I don't know. It's all very weird.
I mean, Yassarian, again, not in the best mind state, but he's like, well, they had all my pals. They're all dead now. We found out about Hungry Joe as well.
There's Milo.
Yeah, after abandoning him in Rome, I don't think he's a pal anymore.
Oh, no, I don't think he was since the situation with Snowden.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't think they've been pals since then.
Not that the morphine would have done any good.
No, but it would have been... He wouldn't be in pain.
Well, okay, yes, you're right.
That's,
Yeah, no, that's very important.
And at least he might have been unconscious.
Yeah, and of course, the kind of the worst part of that whole thing was the false hope, where Yassarian thought, oh, the wound's not too bad, I've done my job. And then he realizes that there was another injury, a much worse injury.
And the fact that Yassarian ended up also with a leg wound?
Mm.
Oh, you know what? That would have not been... Well, I mean, wasn't helping either way, but that would have been a particularly bad thing for him to injure.
Yeah. Would have made him think of Snowden all.
Well, it did, because it got mentioned.
Yeah.
It got mentioned, the whole Snowden secret. Like, the whole... And I think the interesting part about this is... for Yassarian, he does, because he doesn't believe necessarily in God, but he also doesn't not believe in God. He's kind of, well, yeah. He's, I think what he doesn't believe in is organized religion.
I want to say agnostic, but to be honest, I don't think he's really ever given any thought to the matter.
I don't know, because A, he's Assyrian. Religion does play a part there, but also when they said, where were you born? He said the battlefield.
Hmm.
There was war in Assyria, so the chances that he was actually born on the battlefield is not zero. And he does mention something; it comes up here and there that he might have come from a state of conflict.
He makes that, you know, what state were you born in? A state of innocence.
Yeah.
That reflection that horrors should not be inflicted on children, mainly I'm thinking now because he had to endure them as a child.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of layers to it. And the fact that Yassarian, so I think he does believe in the human spirit, so to speak. But the idea of that you are, as a human being, that you're vulnerable, that when the spirit is gone, your body's just like anything.
Meat. Or, well, he used the word garbage.
Well, burn him and he'll rot like other kinds of garbage. So yeah, so that the body is limited in terms of that's not what you are.
Mm.
And that scares him as well, which explains his frenetic behavior. It explains that his fundamental understanding of life and living and being and existing and how he perceives reality was completely shaken.
Mm.
He was confronted by it way too harsh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I guess that's the other thing. Being a bombardier or a fighter pilot, you are kind of it's not like, you know, having a another man in your sights and pulling the trigger or having to get up close and kill him that way. It's like how we talk about how piloting drones these days, like playing a video game, you're very distanced from the harm you're causing.
There's a disconnect between your action and the outcome. Death is a hypothetical for you, or you know,
it's a abstract concept.
Yeah, it's very abstract. And so by being confronted by this, like when you see a plane go down, you don't see the bodies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. When McWatt died, in my head, like the mental picture I had was a very long shot where you just see the plane go into the side of a mountain.
And he's gone,
yeah.
Whereas with other ones, with Kid Samson's, the fact that he's like, no one wanted to just go there because the death was too real.
Yeah, yeah.
Their absence is still there. Like when someone dies, like Clevenger, well, he's gone. We don't know what happened, but he's gone. Same with Orn, all of them. Like, it's for them, the relationship to death is completely distorted. And Ysarion, because he's had to witness this incredibly gruesome situation, is over. Like, for him, that was just it, the breaking point.
Yeah.
And he resents people like Havemeyer and all of them. And I think he also relates closer to... That's why Dunbar and him were relating to each other, because I think Dunbar was over the death as well. The killing and the risk of dying. Probably more the killing than the risk of dying for Dunbar.
Yeah, yeah.
And he was having major moral dilemma. Yeah,
actually,
there.
When you think of their friendship, they're kind of coming at the same moral stance from opposite sides. Dunbar objects to the killing. Ysarion doesn't want to die.
Ysarion doesn't want to die, but also he's tired of death. I think he's just tired of it, and he's tired of being. And then at the end of it, he just fell into an automatic pattern just to get through it, because he was being forced. You're going to have to go on the mission. If you go on the missions, maybe you'll get to go home. You go on the mission, you get to go home. And so he was pushing through the missions to try and get home. And then when Nately died, that was it. He couldn't. That was it. That was his final, like, no, I can't do this anymore.
Yeah.
I can't. This, everyone's dying. Everyone's disappearing. I can't be involved in this anymore. I can't put myself at risk. But also, I think he's tired of death.
You know, I want to mention as well, you know, for the longest time now, maybe even the last 10 chapters or so, a good chunk of the book, we've been sequential. After so much of the book was jumping around willy-nilly, most of the book's been sequential. And then right here, almost for its... With the greatest impact, we go back again for, I'm thinking probably the final time, we jump around in time. We go back to the crux of the whole story, right?
Yeah.
And I just thought that was very powerful to take away the haphazard batting and jumping around that we commented on so much for the good, most of the book, because we haven't had that for so long. And then Heller uses it right again at the end just to really hammer that point home and make,
I
think it's quite masterful.
It's very, like, this is the kind of way to write that's incredible. And yeah, it's very, very powerful. It's a powerful book. I can see why, like, the whole way it's been very well crafted, but it's a very effective way to kind of bring the reader to understand where this person's coming from.
Now that we've read another chapter, do you think that was Nately's girlfriend, or it was an actual assassin, Ysarion? Just
who knows? Who knows? At this point, you can't trust a word Korn says.
No.
Chances that it was Nately's girlfriend is high.
But I really did find that funny that it was how Colonel Korn and Cathcart decided to spin Ysarion's attack. That he confided in the chaplain. He goes, look, it was one thing to just be pals with them and go home, take that as an excuse. But look, my morals aren't completely gone. I can't with good conscience say I saved their lives.
Yeah. Oh.
and I love the chaplain was actually so sad that he might have influenced Ysarion to take this course of action, which is going to be very bad for him.
Well, no, there was something else. He was sad because he was upset that Ysarion took this, yeah?
Until he found out why, yeah.
Yeah. And the problem is that Ysarion, he doesn't deserve to be locked up with the... He doesn't.
No.
He could sacrifice himself. And I mean, if he was in a state where he could, but he's also not in a state where he can make rational decisions anymore.
Yeah.
Or even moral decisions. He's out of that frame of thinking.
Little bits left.
We had little moments with the kid sister. We had little moments like where he's trying, but he's such a shat. Like, it's the fabric of who he is as a person. Maybe arguably that's the thing about war. The brutality of war is a systematic erosion of your very humanity.
Yes.
And it doesn't mean that those who engage, who are former soldiers lack their humanity. It means that it's a space in which the tool of war relies on dehumanization and eroding your, like, absolutely
and no
fabric.
No wonder so many soldiers have trouble reinserting themselves into society because...
Yeah, I'm not surprised. With that kind of extreme, like, it's not surprising. And it's, again, not their fault.
Nope.
It's not their... I would never... Like, if a soldier engages in behavior that is quite deliberately... I mean, obviously, harmful, they're going to be in harmful, but, like, quite deliberately despicable.
Mm-hmm.
Torture, breaching any sort of... Right? And I know people go, but you weren't there, you don't know what it's like. So there's lines, and I'm not the one who's the arbiter of these lines. So whatever the lines are that they're meant to work within and certain moral standards that they're meant to uphold. Again, not surprised if that gets compromised. But the fact that these systems actually, like this process, we know that in some countries, essentially the option is, A, there's drafting in some countries. That's mm-hmm. a thing. So there's no choice in the matter. Then there's other things such as essentially being given the option of go to jail for something that is minor and should probably have just been a fine, which they can't afford, yeah. And then they get into debt, and so they have to go to... So the
Or just the way, you know, you're an 18-year-old kid who maybe hasn't had the best upbringing or you don't see many choices, and someone comes along and goes, hey, this is a good avenue for you to go to.
It's not only that. There's also, I mean, what they're getting Yossarian to do.
Mm-hmm.
To send him back, be a hero, everything talks him up, talks up the army, talks mm-hmm. up the military, talk it up. It's a PR game. We know it's a PR twisting thing. Whatever they're telling, and they're training kids, they're funneling people straight into it. Yep. If you don't get funneled into one system, you get funneled into the other. And we know this. And it's not just limited to one country or another. It's a system that gets applied in different ways. And we know there's industries that rely on war and warfare and all that. It's messy. And we've said it on previous episodes. This is not against a necessary and internationally sanctioned military intervention in the case of where a population is being, you know, put in danger by some sort of action, a deliberate action. Like if one country invades another and there is no purpose for it other than just, you know, it's trying to secure what things. Basically, it gets messy. But I mean, obviously, when all diplomatic options have been exhausted, and that is literally the only way you can stop a dictator from going roughshod over vulnerable populations, then maybe that's obviously, yeah. Again, not my space to make these decisions, but that's the framework that I would personally mm-hmm. work in. But the people that come back, there needs to be a very large amount of compassionate understanding towards their needs to reintegrate and build up and to repair that fabric that is literally their very being is torn.
Yeah.
Unless you are a homicidal, like, you know, and even then, what drives a person to become a homicidal person? Like, what drives that? What causes that? What are the ingredients?
My instinct would be to say trauma.
Yeah. I mean, we throw the word trauma around quite a lot now, and it's a bit of a buzzword. But it's true. It's like a traumatic upbringing, abuse. Again, trauma is not an excuse. But you combine enough things, trauma, lack of access to education, lack of access to a choice. There are people, yes, who do have mental health issues. And if you combine that with all those above, i.e. Havemeyer, that's not good. Then you've got the propaganda that infiltrates all forms of communication, be it media, arts, video games. I'm not saying video games cause violence. Don't worry. That's not what I'm saying. But if you combine enough things together, you are creating in an atmosphere where human life is devalued and...
Well, and just on the video games, while, video games do not cause violence, some of the most popular franchises are unabashedly U.S. military propaganda.
Yep. So so again, this is in no way do I look down on those who have I guess, engaged for whatever reason, had to be in a space where they're engaged in military act. I know people who have. I know black people. No, you know, I know people. Sorry. It's a weird way to phrase it. There's no way anyone in our generation doesn't know at least one person who has been engaged in the military in some way.
It's impossible. No, that's true. I was trying to think if I knew anyone. And no.
Plenty.
I have a friend who served in the first Gulf War.
Yeah, same. Yeah, same. I've got a few friends, and I've known people in all sorts of militaries, and I know in some countries we have also compulsory military service, even if it's for 1 or 2 years when they turn. Like, it's lots of things. That being said, I think we can acknowledge that it has been part of our past as humanity. We can acknowledge that it still continues to some extent right now. But until we also acknowledge that we need to move past this mode of approaching situations, it's enough. We've had two major world wars. Our world has been in continuous conflict for various industrial reasons, sometimes under ethical and moral justifications. But at the end of the day, okay? So there's a lot of murkiness. And until we have absolute transparency, openness, and actual cooperative and collaborative approaches as opposed to constant power play where people get used as friggin' pawns in some sort of major strategical financial agreement. It's corporations being owned by corporations and being used for that. Either way, it's not helpful. Be it politicians or be it for corporations or be it for one ideology or another ideology, this ism versus that ism, this cultural ethnic ethnostate, that cultural ethnostate, this religious group, that religion. Guys, can we, and it can sound very negative and down saying all this stuff. No, we've been through all this stuff. We are to some extent still going through a lot of this stuff. But what we have in common is so much more than what we have that keeps us different.
Yeah, I think most folks would be pretty saddened and disgusted by the portrayal of Snowden's death.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And that's the thing. Like, so we got the kid that lied about his age, and that happens, and that has happened, and that does continue to happen quite a bit, although harder in our information age, but you know. I think Yusarian's statement at the beginning when he goes to the hospital, he says, what were you born in? A state of innocence. We are all born in a state of innocence.
Yeah.
And I guess maybe that's the thing to build on. I think becoming, you know, realigning our priorities. You know, we keep saying, when you grow up, you'll learn priorities. I don't think, but why? Who determines those priorities? Where do they come from? A priority as a child is to have shelter, feel safe, feel loved, be around your family. You don't have ambitions of, oh, I want to take over 3 corporations by the time I'm 5 years old. Like, you know, when you're a child, your ambitions are, yeah, you see, oh, I'd like to help people. Ask children. The most common response is, depending on their environment, but most of the time, a child that is truly still in that innocent state will tend towards altruistic behavior, especially if they see it modeled in front of them, even more so.
But that's the key, modeling. Because children are products of their environment.
They are products of their environment, but their instinct is to reach out, to connect to others, to be with others, to learn from others. That's not war.
Mm.
That's not aggression. If our instinct is to learn and to explore the world together, yeah. So I think maybe we should be learning. It sounds weird, but we should maybe consider returning back to the ambitions of children. And it's not an original thought. Many people have probably said it, but also, like, I have a similar phrase that I've just recently just heard that was essentially saying we should look to children because they act out of purity. They act out of, they're not weird with their ambitions and motivations. You can usually get the truth out of a kid if they, like, so why are you doing it? It's, oh, because I really wanted to see this, or I really wanted to do that, or I wanted to, like, they'll tell you what it is. As long as they trust you, but usually a child, if they have retained their innocence and they are allowed to retain their innocence in terms of their, we're talking innocence as in they haven't seen horrible things in their lives kind of thing, but they haven't been, their trust hasn't been broken, etc. The original, I guess, the original template of a child, so to speak, is just, there's no artifice.
Mm.
There's no lack of sincerity, especially if you encourage a child to be pure in their behavior. And I'm not talking pure as in the freaky, weird, pure discussions that some people have. I'm talking pure as in like sincere, genuine, real.
Yeah. Uncorrupted.
Yeah. Uncorrupted. And oh, that's that chapter. So it's interesting that he's gone from corruption to that discussion of innocence as a continuous theme, the relationship of death, innately in his naive, very innocent way, thinking that he can change someone's life, which he could, and he tried. And even though others were kind of almost laughing at him and dismissing him, and Captain Black was amused at, for, you know, literally the barriers and harm that was put in his way, he still almost succeeded. Yeah. We don't know if he could have succeeded or not. And I think there was hope.
He came from a family of money and influence, so he had a better shot at it than most.
Well, that too, but also he had hope. Mm. He brought hope, and he brought hope to someone who had given up.
And that's probably why her reaction to his death had been so violent.
Yeah, I don't blame her for how distressed and distraught, like, that would have broken her. The fact that she attacks Lutarian is a bit weird, but at the same time, he's the bearer of the news.
Yeah.
And she blames the military, I guess.
Yeah.
And is fixated and on him.
Yeah, I don't understand it myself, but yeah.
I think she fixated on Ysarion because he was the one who told the news, and maybe, I don't know whether the Milo business came to light, but the fact that Milo used the information that Ysarion gave him about Nately to force everyone to have more missions kind of thing.
So. Hmm. Yeah. We may never know the actual motivations, because, you know, with the absurdism of a lot of the book as well, sometimes these things just happen.
I think he just lets people carry it, like, infer and assume, make assumptions about it. And, oh, well, she's just upset. It's like, well, she's more than upset. She's just been broken.
She's homicidal.
Yeah, she's absolutely destroyed. So yeah, the whole thing is very, it's been an interesting, very thought provoking. I think war is a hard topic.
Yes.
And it always will be until we, because mainly, I think anyone who's been in an area where there has been war, or has lived in a space of combat and war, or mm-hmm. has engaged in it. When I was young, I went to a place that had literally had a civil war just a handful, like maybe 3 years previously or so. And it was like, we were still, when people were driving, people had very little, but they made it work. When we were driving through places, like there'd be a massive crater in the middle of the road, and like it was, you know, it's still damaged. They were still fixing things and repairing things, and the people that, but you could see, although you could see the emotional scars and the pain and the frustration, there was also a building of hope that there was a way to live without that anymore. And that was encouraging. And so far, I think they've actually managed to resist. I'm not mentioning the country quite deliberately, but I've been to places where, what was the most freakish thing was so far in my life was to be on a bus. We got early to a bus stop. Early to a bus stop? So we got early to a bus stop. So we got the earlier bus. We went somewhere. And then we heard that literally the bus that we were meant to go on, or right after we had left, the next bus had a bomb on it. Had a suicide bomb attack. I know. Nice. Yeah. So that was weird. But, I mean, I can't say that I've lived through war and stuff like that. But I'm, you know, like, it's even that, or knowing that your siblings are in a place where there's things are unsettled, there's tension, there's difficulties, where things aren't always safe. I've got family members that are all over the world. I had my auntie was working with the United Nations, and she usually was sent to places where it was pretty damn rough. Her task was literally to help support communication between, you know, the different parties, to support them actually talking together and coming up with a solution that would serve their population, as opposed to just our way, your way, my way. It was trying to facilitate things like that, specifically related to healthcare. I think, and for all of us that feel a little bit detached and disconnected, and not necessarily that we, but look, I've never been to war, or I'll never be in that situation, or I have no influence of it. You do, because ultimately you're part of a society in which your attitude towards other people can shape how they see the world as well. And they see the potential that we have as people. If we always just give up and go, oh, well, they're there, we're never going to get there, they're there, they're there. And I wonder, just coming back to Yusarian, that could be it. That he saw something, and when he tried to do something to fix a thing,
yeah,
it ended up being hopeless and useless and wasn't actually addressing it. Well, and all he could say was, they're there.
I think it's even sadder, because I mentioned the false hope. I think it's more that he successfully solved the problem, but it turned out to do no good because he neglected to see the larger problem.
Yes. And that's possibly what it is, because he's afraid of making a decision, because the last time he made a decision, and that's why he didn't make a decision with Dobbs. Last time he made a decision, the person died anyway, and it was horrible. And he also came to a realization that shook his entire existence.
Yes.
And I guess, and every time he's done something, it's not ended well. So he's lost people.
Yeah. It's funny, because I feel like we were both a little critical of him over the last couple of chapters, talking about how, as a protagonist, he really doesn't make decisions. But now, after we've come to a realization of why, and it does give me a little more empathy for him.
I have a lot of empathy. I have empathy for him. It's frustration, because it's, I guess it's because it could have, it's a constant, but only. If Yusarian hadn't moved that line, if this hadn't happened, if he hadn't decided, you know, that kind of stuff, if he hadn't decided to sign letters off.
That's it, back in chapter one.
Yeah, no, but then the chaplain wouldn't be in trouble.
Yeah.
So there's all these things, there's this constant impact, the ripple effect of our actions. Maybe that's another story here that's being told, is that we need to be conscious of the ripple effects. And you can't control
it. It's so hard to know.
No, but you can't control. You can't control. But, I mean, before we started our recording today, that's something that came out. We're talking about, we don't know the impact of our actions, but if we try and, first address the intent, and second, think about the action that either will cause the least harm, but also you can do something.
Mm-hmm.
You might not think it's a big thing, but the little something that you do that works towards the bigger picture that is hopefully not causing harm to others.
The ripple effect, yeah.
Yeah, try and aim for a ripple effect. You can't control where the ripples end up, but you can decide to even toss that first grain of sand into the water. Like, it doesn't matter what it is that you're doing, just do that little thing. Even you do that little thing, that's something. Inaction itself can also be harmful. And I think that's, Yusarian also has that going for him, where he doesn't do things and that causes harm as well.
Yeah.
And I mean, I think of medicine actually in that regard, because when you don't do something and you constantly have a wait and see attitude, that's also not good.
Could be dangerous. But yeah. Maybe he's now realized that as well, because once he heard about how they were spinning his injury, he finally decided, well, I'm not going to stand for that.
Well, did he though? He just kind of like, oh man, just I'm gonna speak up. But then he's been told, well, we've got your pal. So he's gone down a spiral of memory now. So, well, it's like,
oh, you think that we got your pals to threaten him to keep on with the deal?
I think that might be.
Okay. Okay.
Whether they do or they don't.
Well, we have one chapter left to find out what happens. We didn't plan to do a twofer today, and this second one has been, like, the first one was quite easy to talk about, quite easy to read, but this is almost like a climax of the book itself, and now we've just got the fallout, the epilogue.
Yeah, it's...
We get to find out what happens.
We're going to go through the timeline. I'm going to find a thing, and it will go through the timeline, and we'll warn people so that they can watch the series that is in the timeline as well. Man.
Yeah,
it's intense.
Next episode should be an interesting one. This episode was... I really enjoyed the discussion that that last chapter provoked, because, oof, hoobie. I mean, the Eternal City was rough, but... that one was almost equally rough for a not a very different reason, but I guess emotionally different.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting.
Okay, well, as Rue recovers from the chapter, as I recover from the chapter, and hopefully as you all recover from the chapter, we do thank you for joining us today. The music at the top of the podcast is Soap Runs. It's by Rupert Gregson-Williams and Harry Gregson-Williams. It's from the 2019 adaptation of Catch-22. The music at the end of the podcast is I'm the Slime by Frank Zappa. You can find me over on Twitter at Dave_the_turnip.
And you can find me at Rue McMoo and our podcast at SMBSLT Podcast. That's on Twitter. That's on Facebook. And you can also send us an email if you add @gmail.com to the end of that. We like to hear your feedback, and we will surprise you with our book choice next week for the next season.
I already know what it is. You'll have to wait another week. But until next time, we hope you're enjoying your reading. Please stay safe, and we'll see you next episode.